America is backing out. That's a major theme of the news this week. It's easy to understand why. America has huge amounts of debt. It's still spending vast amounts of money keeping the rest of the world safe. So President Trump is working to end expensive wars, to bring peace, something that I'm sure we all want just anyway, and to bring back American troops and to replace them and the force for stability and security that those troops have been. He's working to empower local allies. He's boosting Saudi Arabia. He met, as we talked about last week, with the leaders of Syria's new regime in the Middle East. He's put forward a plan to end the war in Ukraine, and he's pushing Germany to take America's spot as the leading military in Europe. Can this grand global vision work? Well, we'll find out in today's Trumpet World Week in Review. Most of the major stories this week are connected to this American drawdown. And one of the biggest, most eye-catching, most discussed is President Trump's new peace plan for Ukraine. To get the latest on it, as well as the realities on the ground in Ukraine, we'll go to our Asia correspondent, Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, that's right, Mr. Palmer. Actually, before launching into the details of this deal that President Trump is attempting to negotiate, I wanted to mention that Russia has just carried out one of its most lethal strikes on civilians in Western Ukraine of the whole war. And of course, this strike, I think, really robs hope from the efforts that are being made to end this horrific war on terms that could have some real staying power and be reasonable, really, for both sides. So this strike happened in the early hours of Wednesday. That's when Russia fired cruise missiles and drones, not at any sort of military target, but on families sleeping in their beds in apartment buildings. This was in the city of Ternopil. And Ternopil is way over on the western side of Ukraine. So there's no chance of this being mistaken for some sort of a military target. It's only about 150 miles from the border of Poland. So hundreds of miles from the war's front lines. And he struck apartments full of children and mothers and fathers. And really, Vladimir Putin has been targeting civilians since the start of this full-scale war almost 4 years ago now. So it really shouldn't shock us to see him continuing this just monstrously wicked tactic. But he did strike this residential block in Ternopil. He fired 48 missiles and more than 400 drones during this attack, and many of them were able to get past Ukraine's defenses. So it was a victory for Russia. They managed to kill 28 civilians, including 3 children, and they also wounded another 93 people, including 18 children. And in many cases, these wounds are extremely serious, so the death toll could actually rise in the days and weeks ahead. So Putin achieved his aim here, taking the lives of children as they slept in their beds and killing and wounding many other people as well. And of course, the timing of this is very interesting because right around the same time of this attack, we received word that U.S. President Donald Trump has been secretly working with the Russians to draft a new plan to end the war. So it's been happening through some back channels rather than in a public forum of any kind. And this new plan appears to be fairly similar to other peace plans that Mr. Trump's team has come up with, in that it's very pro-Russian. And it's extremely short-sighted. So it says that Russia will get all of the Donbass region, including parts of it that Russia has been trying for 11 years to seize militarily, you know, since shortly after the annexation of Crimea. So for 11 years, he's been trying to take some of these parts of the Donbass, and they failed. But now this new deal would say, even though you failed to take it militarily, you get to have it anyway. And then the U.S., according to this new deal, would also legally recognize Russian control over the Donbass and Crimea. And then the Ukrainian military, according to these terms, would be slashed to less than half its size, and the Ukrainians would be banned from having certain weapons systems, almost certainly including serious rocket systems, missile, you know, missile delivery systems. America would also end its military support for Ukraine. All of that would be phased out. So it's a sort of thing that would it would really allow the Russians to claim a significant victory right now in the short term. But even more significantly, it would let them quickly rebuild their power. And it would allow the Russians time to just sort of regroup and rearm and then wage war again in a few years, this time against a Ukraine that has been stripped of much of its power, and this time from positions that are well established right there at the new border. So it would almost certainly go very terribly for the Ukrainians. So it's a terrible plan for Ukraine, but the Russians and the Trump administration know that Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is in a weakened state right now. A big corruption scandal has blown up over the past couple of weeks, implicating several of Zelensky's allies and weakening his parliamentary majority as well. There's even speculation that Zelensky himself may be forced to step down as a result of this. So he is in a weakened state, and he has less leverage to negotiate and less leverage to be able to refuse even a very bad, extremely pro-Russian type of deal. So, you know, in a way, we have been here before, several times over the last few months with various bad deals that Russia and the Trump administration have tried to impose on Ukraine, even while Russia's flagrantly violating the terms of the deal. And so far, none of these have had any real impact, and the war has continued on. But there are some different factors right now, this time around, particularly with Ukraine being in such a weakened political state, with the government there being so weakened. And then Russia right now is also in a weakened state, with its economy beginning to feel some very serious pain. So Russia also has more motivation to want to buy itself some time at present. So we still don't know for sure how this will turn out, but it could be different this time around. But however this latest attempt at peace does turn out, it does bring to mind an article by Trump Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry. This was written in our April issue, and it's called, "Does Donald Trump Know the Way to Peace?" And I just want to read one section of this article. It says, "Peace is a noble goal, but if it's pursued the wrong way, that effort ends up achieving the opposite. Putin is an evil, ruthless, vindictive agent with Soviet-style methods of psychological warfare, assassination, and war. He has disgusting and devastating policies that are sick to the core and even satanic. Trump believes he can negotiate with Putin, giving him sections of Ukraine and expecting this to pacify him. That reveals a total lack of comprehension of the man he's dealing with. Can God get along with the devil?" So quite a blistering statement there from Mr. Flurry's article. And once again, that article is called, "Does Donald Trump Know the Way to Peace?" This is a very insightful article that actually explains who Vladimir Putin is in Bible prophecy and shows that there's no cause for optimism when it comes to negotiations for peace with this man. So if anyone would like to understand that, I hope that you'll take a look at that article. Once again, "Does Donald Trump Know the Way to Peace?"
Thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. Yeah, we'll definitely put a link to that in our show notes. You know, I think on this story, it's pretty understandable that you've got a strong segment, I guess, at least in the United States, that are like, well, we're spending a lot of money on Ukraine. I think the amount of money is often exaggerated. I think someone left a comment a few weeks ago saying, well, America's bankrupted itself because we've been giving all this money to Ukraine. And it's like, well, you know, the amount of money that America has been giving to Ukraine is at an infinitesimally tiny fraction of the way America's bankrupted itself. It's not really that much money. But still, it is money. And when you are growing in debt, then you need to, you know, saying, well, I'm not going to, if it's personal finance, going and still buying a cup of coffee, say, when you've got masses of credit card debt, you know, that is a habit you'd have to stop. So America's grappling with this situation. I think it is understandable that people are saying, well, we need to find ways to pull out here. I mean, so what is the solution then? If doing a deal with Vladimir Putin is doing a deal with the devil, then how do you bring peace? And I think this is, I think this is a point where you think about this, you look at this, and really it's so many of the different, God has lined up so many different world events here. And even the scale of the crisis facing America internally and externally, where he's leading us to the conclusion that the only solution is to turn to him. So you look at Ukraine, like, how do you deal? How do you bring peace to Ukraine? And not just Ukraine, but all of Russia's neighbors. You do have to deal with Vladimir Putin. Vladimir Putin has nuclear weapons. So, I mean, humanly, we're looking at an insoluble problem, that there isn't a human solution. And if we really want to bring peace, we've got to bring God into it. And that's I think, the conclusion of, like I said, internal news, external news. I don't know if you had any thoughts to add. That's just been my musings on this subject this week, thinking about this peace deal.
Well, I mean, it's a good point. This is certainly a very complex geopolitical situation here, and particularly the way aid and weaponry to Ukraine has been slow-walked and so many restrictions have been put on it. I think that had Ukraine been armed more robustly, more quickly, so that the cost for Russia to keep pushing was just too high, then the Russians would have ended this attempt a little bit earlier. But anything short of a military defeat for Russia will not solve this problem. And so that's why this very gingerly approach that we saw under the Biden administration, with restrictions placed on the ATACMS and everything else, it was really that just emboldened the Russians. And as for the money, from what I understand, under President Biden, it equated to somewhere around 5% of America's defense budget. So that's significant. But this is not a problem that we can wash our hands off in America. Isolationists would like to say that we can, but we know from history that if an aggressor is not stopped, that problem becomes a global problem. It'll quickly go from regional to global. So it would be great to say, sorry, we don't have the money. You guys can work this out for yourselves. But, you know, the isolationists in history have often been humbled by that sort of thinking in the past. So it would be great to live on a planet that didn't have any aggressors that you had to fork over exorbitant sums of money to try to keep contained. But we have learned that the Russians, much like many of history's other aggressors, they only really respond to overwhelming force. And Russia has had military defeats. You can look at Afghanistan in the 80s. They lost too much blood, they lost too much treasure, and they finally backed out. And I think that same situation could easily play out in Ukraine if more spine were shown by those who are assisting the Ukrainians. And that way it would be less expensive eventually, both in blood and treasure.
That's a good point. And it's, you know, okay, I think in the long run we can see we can only bring peace to the world through God's help. The only way you're going to have a permanent lasting peace. But that doesn't mean there aren't better ways of doing things and better ways of solving this particular situation and maybe more wisdom that can be brought to bear. I think your point as well about America's responsibilities, I mean, that highlights some of the contradictions in this deal, that one of the ways that America wants to bring peace to this situation is to have security guarantee, where America says, okay, if Russia attacks Ukraine, we promise to defend Ukraine. Of course, America gave Ukraine that security guarantee back in 1994 and didn't follow through on it. So, you know, if you make promises and don't follow through, you're not going to be able to use those promises again to be able to try and defuse a conflict or something like that. It erodes the value of trust in America as an ally and ultimately America's global power. So a lot of different factions here, but I think or factors here, but a key one is what you highlighted, that prophesied role that Vladimir Putin is going to play, is already playing, that he's not going to disappear from the scene here, and that his aggression is going to play a critical role and an important role, not the only role, but an important role in the prophesied events of the future and the whole world moving towards World War III. And the Afghanistan comparison is pretty sobering. If there was a bit more resistance, I mean, obviously the defeat in Afghanistan ultimately led to the fall of the Soviet Union. If there were more resistance and you had a defeat in Ukraine, Would that start a chain reaction that would lead to the end of Vladimir Putin? Maybe there is a massive missed opportunity here. But again, you know, we know the role that Vladimir Putin is going to play. What other Asian news did you have for us, Jeremiah?
Yes, well, first up, just a quick one about new evidence emerging that has shown just how deep China's support for Russia's war effort has been. It shows that China has been providing Belarus with assembly line equipment, so basically production equipment, to make munitions that end up in the hands of Russian soldiers in Ukraine. So China sends all this factory equipment to Belarus. I think they're nervous about doing it directly with Russia, but Belarus at this point is basically a Russian satellite or a client state, you could say. So China's sending equipment there to Belarus instead, and it also sends engineers to Belarus to set up all of this equipment and to train the Belarusians to use it. And these facilities are making about 500,000 artillery shells for Russia every year. So some very significant numbers. And this shows that whatever the Chinese may sometimes say about neutrality in this war, those claims are growing more ludicrous by the week. It is inescapably clear that the Chinese are fully aligned with the Russians and they're backing them in some very significant ways. And then one final story here about Chinese fishermen operating off the coast of Peru. So these guys are thousands of miles from home, but they were caught with 10,000 shark fins in their vessels. 10,000 shark fins, many of which were from threatened shark species. In China, you can make big bucks with shark fins because people think that it has medicinal properties, even mystic properties, perhaps. Shark fin soup sells for around $100 a bowl there. So it's just a huge market, a black market. And the cruelty of this trade is well documented. The fishermen are often in a hurry and they want to maximize their profits, so they just slice the fin off of living sharks and then throw the mutilated animal back into the ocean where it slowly dies of blood loss or suffocation. So it's terribly cruel, and it is banned by many nations. And sharks are also, they play a critical role in many ecosystems as the apex predator. And certain species are under serious threat because of the Chinese appetite for these sharks. So it's good news that the Chinese fishermen were caught by Peruvian authorities, and the 10,000 fins that they had there are valued at more than $11 million, since you can make many bowls of soup from a single fin. But the quantity here makes this one of the largest wildlife trafficking operations in the history of Latin America, and it shows that the Chinese threat and their hardening determination to just dominate the world, it takes many different forms.
Well, thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. I wanted to slip in my European story at this point, because I think it's part of this same America pulling out. And bringing an end to the war in Ukraine and ending the quite large amounts of military assistance that America's giving to Ukraine at the moment, that is a big part of Donald Trump's program. But also, in the long term, ending the time where it has to lead NATO and be responsible for Europe's security. That is another critical goal. And we saw a major statement of that goal this week at the Berlin Security Conference on Wednesday, where Matthew Whitaker, the US ambassador to NATO, made quite a remarkable statement. I don't think there's publicly available video of this, but the statement was, "I look forward to the day when Germany comes to the United States and says that we're ready to take over the supreme allied commander position. I think we're a long way from that, but I look forward to those discussions." And the Times said that this statement elicited shock from a German NATO general seated next to him. And indeed, Germany's Lieutenant General Wolfgang Wien said that he was a little bit astonished by this statement. And there's good reason for that. This statement is quite a bit more dramatic than may first appear. In times of war, the supreme commander of Europe in NATO, he would control the deployment of hundreds of thousands of troops, and perhaps even control the deployment, maybe even use of nuclear weapons. And right now, America is the backbone of those forces. It would provide the largest contingent of those forces, if not most of the forces. It would provide the nuclear weapons. It would provide the airlift, the logistics, the bulk of the air support, missile support, the bulk of the space technology. that would all come from the United States. And so that supreme commander has always been an American. General Eisenhower was the first NATO supreme commander. And so what Whitaker is suggesting is backbone replacement surgery for NATO. He is saying that Germany should take America's place as the backbone of NATO. And this isn't just Whitaker's off-the-cuff comments. The Telegraph writes, for months, rumors have swirled that the US is eager to step back from the role and allow a European general to take command. And the Times reported that actually the rumors had gotten so strong that European ambassadors had kind of lobbied Republican senators and congressmen to go and talk to Donald Trump about this. And Whitaker, you know, he is clear that this is a very big step. He said, maybe in 15 years, maybe sooner, we'll have that discussion where Europe says they're ready to take over the true leadership that the United States has published over the last 76 years. So he sees that this is not at all a small step. But Germany is, he's right, Germany is preparing to take that step. They're making some massive changes to their military. They've already doubled their military spending compared to where it was. Friedrich Merz has said that he wants to make the German army the strongest conventional army in Europe, and Whitaker praised Germany for this. He called Germany's massive rearmament a clear example for the rest of Europe and basically told everyone else, you need to step up. Well, he used the word step up. You need to step up just like Germany is doing. So here we see America very keen to get out of Europe and its involvement in NATO that really has kept the peace in a war-torn continent for 75 years. And again, I can completely understand why. I think America has, you know, they've kept the peace in a continent that has been torn with war for centuries. And Europeans, and I think even British people, we could be more grateful for the role that America has played in that. I mean, what America has benefited, absolutely. It's been in America's interest. You know, I'm not saying they've necessarily done that at their own hurt. You know, by preventing the Soviet Union from conquering all of Western Europe and by preventing that Nazi Germany before then and being involved with Britain and Russia to prevent Nazi Germany from conquering all of Europe, you know, that benefited America. Any power that's able to conquer all of Europe is going to be a massive, imminent, credible threat to the United States. But still, it's been America's largely garnered anti-Americanism, criticism, complaint for doing that. And so now there's a lot, not just Donald Trump, there's a lot that say, well, let's get out of here. But this is also exactly what Herbert W. Armstrong warned about for years. I mean, let's play a clip from him now where he gives that warning.
And some of us, my friends, know not only what we see when we're over there, but we know also what is prophesied. And we know what is prophesied to rise up in Europe. And we know which is the one and the only nation in Europe that is capable of dominating, and which is the economic and the industrial heart of all Europe, without which there could be no stability and strength. A human body cannot live without its heart. And the economic and the military body that is to rise up and to restore the Roman Empire, the thing that we least suspect here in the United States, it cannot rise up without its heart. And its heart is in Germany.
He spent decades saying Germany's going to rise again. Germany's going to lead Europe. America is empowering that, even though the Europeans don't really and the Germans don't really have much love for America. And it's dangerous. And it is absolutely going to backfire. And that is turbocharged now. And you're seeing America building up this Europe that is going to be, that's going to attack, ultimately besiege, bring down the United States. And they're actively putting Germany in that position. I also think it's interesting, you look at NATO's history, vast majority of the time, the deputy supreme commander has been a British general. There have been times of exceptions, and those exceptions have generally been German generals or admirals, but they've been German military leaders. But they didn't turn to Britain. They turned to Germany. Germany is the one that we see replacing us. America is turning to Germany, and Germany is going to betray them. And that is a critical prophesied dynamic. The Bible says that America is going to look to lovers and that those lovers are going to betray you. That America is going to look to other countries, countries that have been cooperating with America out of their own self-interest because they've been benefiting. but say, no, actually, they share our values. They really love me. I can rely on them. I can trust them. I'm going to empower them. And I'll say to my lovers, here, you take over Europe. I'll give you a whole bunch of nuclear bombs. I'll sell you the planes to fly them. That's what they've done for Germany. I'm going to take a step back. You handle it. And God says, because they're relying on foreign lovers instead of on God, that is going to backfire horribly. And it's the same point that we're making talking about Russia. America, God is bringing America to the point where they need to realize that's their only solution, repentance, turning to God. And it could well take, and probably will take, that besiege, that attack, before America reaches that point of repentance, you know, the nation being brought down. But that's the solution here. America has trusted in its own military might to protect itself and the whole world, and it has done quite a lot of good in preserving peace and commerce all over the world, and it's led to it shared an era of prosperity around the whole world. But it's also been incredibly expensive, and the debts are piling up, and it's, if you're going to rely on yourself for peace that way, that's hard, and that is very hard in the long run. So now America's looking at relying on foreign lovers to preserve peace, and the Bible says that's not going to work. But God is the sure solution for peace. And this is something that Mr. Armstrong talked about as well.
Thou shalt love the eternal thy God with all your mind and heart and soul and strength. That's the first and great commandment. We violate that as a nation. Now, I don't think we realize we're doing it. I don't think we do at all. I think we sincerely think. We've just kidded ourselves into thinking, we've been deceived into believing that we're really relying on God. But then, you know, we think that God is sort of a myth and he's far off and maybe he's not real and maybe he couldn't really help us. So we must depend on something that is real. We must depend on something that we can see. And so now we're so afraid of Russia that the United States government feels that it must take a what we call a calculated risk, you know, and try to build up Germany and Central Europe against Russia. All right, you'll see what we're building. And you're not going to have to wait more than 15 years to see it, and I don't think you'll wait that long.
So like I said, I mean, this is what Mr. Armstrong talked about for years, and this is proof, not in Mr. Armstrong's superior ability as a forecaster. He was making these forecasts based on the Bible. This is proof of the Bible. And this is proof of God working through the ministry of Herbert W. Armstrong, revealing truth to him, proof of the accuracy of that message that he sounded all around the world. And we have our book, He Was Right. We're working on an updated version, so maybe hold off on ordering the print copy until we've got that done. But Atlantic Rift is still very up to date, a chapter from that book, and we can put that in the show notes as well. But all of this, you know, the reason why we emphasize Mr. Armstrong was right, I mean, we're emphasizing the Bible is real. The Bible is powerful. The Bible is describing your world right now. If you want to understand your world, if you want to understand your life, if you want to understand the problems that you face, dig into the Bible. And what God revealed to Mr. Armstrong can help you do that. And so we have He Was Right that focuses on the prophecies of Herbert W., well, the prophecies of the Bible, but that Herbert W. Armstrong wrote about. Mystery of the Ages was his final major work, his last book. And that will help bring the Bible to life and help you apply that to how you live your life. And when we talk about, well, you know, you see the Bible being proven true in the headlines in the Telegraph from this week, that can help you in your Christian life, revealing in your way of life, you're revealing the power of the Bible, and help you dig into that through some of those other books, like Mystery of the Ages as well. And all of those books, all of this material, again, it's on our website, absolutely free of charge. Just a little bit more from Europe before we bring into it a very similar story from the Middle East. Also at that Berlin Security Conference, the German defense minister and his Swiss counterpart signed a memorandum of understanding, increasing the security and defense partnership between the two of them, where they're going to, they're already doing a lot of work together, bringing in, importing weapons, their navies working together within the North Sea, within the Baltic. You have German submarines using a Swedish military base the Air Force training together. They're going to have more joint projects coming together. I mean, that's a part of this trend of Europe rising to take on the United States. Is also Europe coming together, pooling their resources so that they can do that. You also had Cyprus resume the assume their 6-month rotating presidency of the Council of the European Union, or they're preparing for that in January. And so Germany, the de facto leader of the European Union, you had the Cypriot president go and touch bases in Germany, visit Germany last Friday to kind of discuss the presidency, set priorities. So you see more of that leadership. And then also, this is just over a week ago, you have a new censorship initiative from the European Union. This is the European Democracy Shield. They put out a deliberately bland and boring press release. You also had, a deliberately bland and boring set of speeches and statements from the European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen. Doesn't sound like much, but when you translate all of the bureaucratese into English, it is, well, it's a continuation of what they're doing already and a unification of what they're doing already, but it is very anti-free speech. So they're going to set up an independent European nation of fact checkers to boost fact checking capacity. In other words, you're going to have more EU paid fact checkers. Independent means paid by the European Union. You know, that's in their language. Independent means not independent. Independent means dependent on the European government, as opposed to being, I guess, dependent on foreign government or dependent on their own ideas. So independent means not independent. So not independent fact checkers will be on social media. They say that they're going to have reinforced financial support for independent and local journalism. So again, the European Commission is going to pay more journalists and more news outlets and give them more bribe money to report the news the way that the European Union would like it reported. They said that they're going to help recognize and counter information manipulation, and so the Commission will roll out measures to foster media and digital literacy for all ages. This means more EU propaganda in schools. It's already there. They're going to step up indoctrination of children, but for all ages, it'll be there in libraries and other any opportunity the European Union can have. And then they said freedom of speech remains for everyone. At the same time, however, citizens must be free from interference. So again, you can say whatever you like, provided the EU like what you're saying. That is what that really means. And we have an article, Germany is taking control of the internet, from Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry, all about this subject. And it really does expose the character of the European Union. They want to control what people think and what people say. So that's about it for Europe. We'll move on to the Middle East, where, again, we've got a similar story. America wants to step back from Europe, and they're handing a lot of... they want to hand over the keys to Germany. In the Middle East, there isn't one obvious candidate to hand the keys to. I mean, Israel, for example, does not lead and dominate the Middle East the way that Germany does. Europe, you certainly don't have the Arab countries actively looking to Israel for leadership. Even though Israel is a close American ally, they can't really do that with Israel. But America is looking at a network of countries, a network of allies to hold the peace in their stead. A key part of that network, though, is Saudi Arabia. And we had some pretty big developments in American-Saudi relations this week. So we'll go to our Middle East correspondent, Mihailo Zekic, to hear more on that.
Yes, on November 18th, Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince and de facto leader of Saudi Arabia, visited the White House in what was not a state visit, because he's technically not a head of state, but it was a lot more lavish than a lot of other state visits would have been. There was a military flyover to greet him, the Marine Band. President Trump hosted a black tie dinner for him at the White House with celebrities like Cristiano Ronaldo, the football superstar that's now living in Saudi Arabia. Elon Musk, he's back in Trump's good graces. He was there. Tim Cook, Jensen Huang, a lot of these very big business moguls were there to greet him. This is the first time Mohammed bin Salman has been in the States since Jamal Khashoggi, a Saudi reporter, was murdered, reportedly on bin Salman's orders, in a Saudi consulate in Istanbul in 2018. And President Trump was asked about Khashoggi's murder, and his response was, and I quote, "things happen." And then he went on to deny his own CIA report, saying that Mohammed bin Salman had something to do with it. Khashoggi, he was not a darling of Western values. He's written some pro-Osama bin Laden stuff before this. I don't want to make it sound like he was the darling of liberal democracy, like a lot of people paint him, but he still was murdered on most likely bin Salman's orders. But the optics, the pomp, that was not the only eye-catching moment of his trip. While he was in Washington, President Trump gave Saudi Arabia a slew of benefits. Saudi Arabia is now designated a major non-NATO ally, which basically means that the U.S. can do intelligence sharing, research and development sharing, weapons sharing, ammunition sharing with Saudi Arabia in a way that they can't really do with any other country outside of the NATO alliance. They've also agreed to sell F-35, the really coveted fighter jets, to Saudi Arabia. A recent Air Force exercise had F-35s achieve a 20-to-1 kill ratio in those exercises. Is usually very reluctant to sell F-35s to most countries. The only country in the Middle East that has them is Israel, and they've balked before at the idea of other countries in the Middle East, even friendly ones, getting them. But now Saudi Arabia will be having those. For some context, they're the same planes Israel used to bomb Iran earlier this year. And now Saudi Arabia, which is a lot closer to Israel than is Iran, is now getting them. What caught my eye most of all was that Trump announced that they will have preparations with, among all everything else going on, for a Saudi nuclear program for America and Saudi Arabia to jointly establish. This caught my eye because this was something Saudi Arabia has been asking for a long time, for years now, before October 7th even. And the Biden administration actually said, sure, but we want to have safeguards that this is not going to be turning into a weaponized military program. It's just for civilian use only, and Saudi Arabia rejected that. And now it looks like, from the details we can see, President Trump is willing to give them the green light for their version of a nuclear deal. There is only one reason Saudi Arabia, the biggest fossil fuel exporter in the world, would want to switch over to nuclear energy, and that's because of their neighbor across the Persian Gulf, Iran, who has their nuclear program, who wants nuclear weapons, who there's plenty of people in Iran that probably want to use nuclear weapons, and Saudi Arabia weapons of their own. Crown Prince Mohammed himself said so in a Fox News interview that we've played over and over in some of our past episodes on this. And now President Trump apparently A agrees with them and doesn't really see any danger in giving the host country of the 9/11 terrorists a nuclear program. He's been talking, I might digress a little bit here. He's talking about making peace with Israel, with Palestine, with Syria, with all these countries, about how we're bringing eternal peace to the Middle East finally. Does eternal peace look like giving the Saudis, of all people, nuclear weapons? But again, I digress a little bit about that. Speaking regarding Israel, Crown Prince Mohammed said that he supports Saudi Arabia joining the Abraham Accords as long as there is a viable path for a Palestinian state to be formed. This is interesting because everything we just talked about now, the nuclear program, the F-35s, those originally, based off of notes we've seen from previous rounds of talk, Saudi Arabia joining the Abraham Accords was to be the condition for all these gifts being given now. But now it looks like President Trump is willing to give Saudi Arabia all these gifts, all these bonuses that not many other countries in the world share without joining the Abraham Accords. And Israel's relations with the Palestinians being what they are, it doesn't take much for something the Palestinians do, for something an outside actor does to throw every development they're off, and the Saudis will have, as always, a convenient excuse to say, okay, the state's off, we're not joining the Abraham Accord. So this is basically like you were talking about earlier with Ukraine, an empty promise that they could keep making and never really fulfill. So quite a lot of bending over backwards from this administration of the White House to make Saudi Arabia as happy, as rich, as powerful as they could possibly make it without really getting much in return.
And I guess, of course, the big question is why, which, when we kind of set up from the beginning, is America backing out of the Middle East? I mean, is that it, or is there more to it than this as well? I mean, you mentioned the Abraham Accords, that was kind of something America wanted. Okay, they've dropped the condition, but is this still done out of the hope that if we're nice to the Saudis, then maybe they'll sign up to that in the future? Is it to build up the Saudis as an opposition for Iran? Like, why is this?
Well, I think it's everything that you just mentioned tied together with one other, maybe more simplistic, perhaps even hard to believe reason, but I think it's extremely valid. And I think that's just plain flattery. Saudi Arabia was the first country that President Trump visited back in his first term, where he had the famous sword dancing video. In this trip, Mohammed bin Salman $1 trillion in the United States in various ways, which you've mentioned in some of your coverage, I believe, or some private discussions we've had, that it's pretty hard for Saudi Arabia to deliver on this with everything they're promising. But again, it's another promise that sounds really good to a president that's trying to bring back American jobs, is trying to look for allies that give him money instead of America sending them money. Our editor-in-chief has talked about Qatar, another Persian Gulf state, and how they've gifted the United States a very posh, very polished Air Force One that President Trump made a big deal about, and looks like is influencing a lot of what he thinks about that country. The Gulf states, they're very well known for spending money in very ostentatious, outlandish ways, really. Like, pardon me. Like, they even were able to purchase the most famous football star in the world to perform in the middle of the desert for them. A lot of these, you think about like the skylines of Dubai and all these record-breaking buildings popping out in the middle of the desert for no reason. Mr. Trump is an entertainment man. A lot of analysts often talk about how his perspective in the real estate world, in the entertainment world, they influence what he does in government now. And I think this kind of flashy money talks, money can solve all problems vision that the Saudis and other governments put forward, that really resonates with them. And he's able to overlook a lot of strings attached to because of that.
So money is clearly not going to solve all of our problems, and like you pointed out, it's pretty clear to see the dangers of helping a Islamic state like Saudi Arabia develop nuclear power, trusting them with the F-35. I understand it will be a slightly less capable version of the F-35 than Israel will be getting, but still cutting edge technology that America's denied to Turkey, a NATO ally. So this is a very high level of trust. Common sense, recent history warns about the danger here. The Bible gives or backs up that warning with even more specific details.
Yes, the prophecy I seem to keep going to over and over again on this program, it gets more and more relevant with each week, is Psalm 83, which speaks of a group of countries in the Middle East coming together. Verse 4 reads that the name of Israel may be no more in remembrance. And that's just not referring to the state of Israel in the Middle East. That's referring to the United States, as you could read in our free book by Herbert W. Armstrong, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, which we've talked about on this program many times. And verses 6 through 8 talk about the countries that are going to be part of this alliance, and it specifically mentions the Ishmaelites. Now, some of these other peoples, like we've talked about how Edom represents Turkey in this program before, Moab and Ammon represents Jordan, and that's based off of secular research and as well as what the Bible says. An alliance like this has never happened before, which is why our editor-in-chief, Mr. Joe Fleury, says it's being prophecy today. The Ishmaelites, you don't need to have these sets of genealogies in front of you to figure out who's who. That's according to Islamic tradition, according to the very people's themselves tradition. The descendants of Ishmael, the patriarch Ishmael, are the Peninsula Arabs today. Are the Arabs that lived around Mecca, that gave birth to Islam, that settled in the peninsula to this day. And Saudi Arabia is by and large the most powerful of these peninsular Arabs. And for America to be putting so much trust in these groups, well, Mr. Fleury had this to say when the Abraham Accords originally happened between the United States, Israel, and the United Arab Emirates. This is what he wrote, quote, "We all want peace, but sadly these recent peace pacts have a deadly flaw. Biblical prophecy gives us deep insight into these agreements. It actually foretells that modern Arabs will unite, somewhat like we are now seeing, but they are prophesied not to cooperate with the United States or Israel." Further down, "While it seems that these nations are moving away from radicalism and violence, we must look beneath the surface. After all, this prophecy reveals that they will take crafty counsel, subtle and shrewd dealing. This sure prophecy shows that these nations will ally to try to blot out the name of Israel forever. That is intense hatred." End quote. Now, he wrote about this between Israel and the United Arab Emirates. The UAE is a much smaller country, much less influential. Saudi Arabia is the top dog as far as the modern Arabs go. And now we're even sidestepping Israel and bringing the United States and all of its sensitive military secrets and its technology into the picture. If what Mr. Fleury said applies to Israel and the UAE, then surely it applies even more so to the United States and Saudi Arabia. And if our viewers would like to learn more, I'd recommend that article, Deadly Flaw in Mideast Peace Deals is what it's called. We can put a link to that in the show notes. And I'd also recommend one of the guest hosts in our sister program, The Trumpet Daily, Mr. Sam Livingston, had a full hour episode just about this called Setting the Stage for Betrayal. If you can't get enough of Saudi Arabia, if you want even more, I highly recommend looking at that program from earlier this week.
That's a great way to get caught up in that story as well. And yeah, I'm glad you mentioned the Trumpet Daily Show. You can get that on YouTube and on Rumble on our website as well. And that's you'll tend to get a lot more focus on the US news and what's been happening on the United States. There has been a lot going on there this week, a lot going on around the world as well. So we've kind of saved Andrew to last. But if you want a lot more on that, Trumpet Daily Show is a great place to get a lot more of that. And then also some Bible studies and some deep insights and practical Christian living material as well. So we do want to really encourage you to listen to that. Before we get Andrew in here, though, Mihailo, did you have any other stories to talk about from the Middle East?
On Wednesday, the Israeli government, on behalf of Mossad, sent out a press release about fighting what they call the Hamas octopus, or Hamas's terror cells throughout Europe and the wider world. This is technically a response to several busts that had happened, or sting operations that had happened since September in Europe, but this is now, to my knowledge, the first time the Mossad is commenting directly about all of these as a cohesive unit. And they mentioned that these are, well, first off, the stories themselves are weapons caches and terror operatives planning terror attacks against Israelis and local Jews in European countries. And Israel made a big deal in this press release on how it's that they're fighting together with Germany and Austria to fight Hamas. We've talked before in this program how Israel, in its war with the Palestinians, is going to look to Germany against or for help. And now we're seeing Germany being dragged into this war while the ceasefire still hasn't morphed into an actual peace treaty yet between Israel and Hamas. The war with Hamas is becoming Germany's war, and Israel is looking to Germany and Austria as partners. And other Bible prophecies show that this is not going to end well for Israel. And speaking of Hamas, one other story, Israeli public broadcaster Khan this week reported that Hamas has been establishing a network not just in Europe, but also in Yemen, in unnamed countries in Africa, to stockpile weapons for when the next phase of the war starts, to be smuggled into Gaza to continue fighting into Israel. So again, all this talk about eternal peace, about how we finally brought all the sides together. Hamas, they're already planning for round two, and they have a lot of friends throughout the greater Middle East and Africa to help them with that. So we can expect a lot more tremors in that front as well in the future.
Thank you for that, Mihailo. Well, going back to the rising power that we talked about in Europe, one major part of that power is going to be the Roman Catholic Church. Europe has tried to come together as a political union, as an economic union, even as a military alliance, and they've not succeeded in the way that they want to. It's going to take a religious union. It's going to take the Catholic Church and the papacy to bring them together, to provide that sense of common purpose and common self that the European Union will need to exist even momentarily as a super state. And so that's why we watch news around, well, a lot of religious news, news around the Catholic Church very closely. And there are a number of key Bible prophecies that relate directly to that that broader picture. One piece of religious news and a fulfillment of one of these specific prophecies has caught Andrew's eye this week. So to hear more about that, we'll go to our correspondent for the English language world, Andrew Miller.
Yeah, this is a really fascinating story to me, and I'm sure it'll be to many of our listeners as well. This week, I feel like most of the big Anglo-American news that got the headlines was all about Donald Trump's peace deals. And we've talked about that on this program quite a bit already. But here's another headline that kind of flew under the radar. A report in the Telegraph on a more long-term trend is just the sheer number of Anglican priests who've joined the Catholic Church, specifically since 1992, when the Anglican Church ruled that women could be bishops. There were many, many Anglican vicars, many Anglican priests who are upset with that and have started joining the Catholic Church. I believe that's a trend that's intensified as the Anglican Church has made even more and more woke decisions in recent days. But this report in the Telegraph has actually showed that about 700 Anglican priests have joined the Roman Catholic Church since 1992. And now that might not sound like a huge number until you start looking at it comparatively to how many there are. Because that 700, that accounts for about one-third of all new Catholic priests in England and Wales in those years. So since 1992, like a third of all the new Catholic priests are not young Catholics who decided to go to seminary and become a priest, but actually priests from the Anglican Church who've decided to switch churches. A huge trend for England and a harbinger of things to come in other nations. 1700th anniversary of the Council of Nicaea. Pope Leo, the first pope from the United States, is going to Nicaea at the end of the month to commemorate that. For those who don't know much of that history, Nicaea is the council where basically the anniversary of the church-state union. Before that, the Catholic Church and all other denominations of Christian churches were persecuted by the Roman Empire. And at Nicaea, the Roman Empire basically sanctioned the Catholic Church as a state-enforced version of Christianity. And they did their Nicene Creed, stating their belief in the Trinity, a creed that actually the Catholic, Orthodox, and at least the mainstream Protestant denominations, Anglicans, Lutherans, Calvinists, agree on. So I think this year a lot of people they're still kind of trying to downplay the church-state union aspect of it, but they're holding up Nicaea as like the common denominator between Catholicism, Orthodoxy, and mainstream Protestantism to try to promote Christian unity. Because as we've pointed out on this program before, in Bible prophecy, a beast is the symbol of a human government, and the woman is a symbol of a church. And so in Isaiah 47, they talk about this woman, this daughter of Babylon, this woman or church, who says, I will not sit a widow, nor will I suffer the loss of children. And so it's this church who wants to restore her diplomatic relations with the human government so it won't sit a widow, and then also bring back all the children or protesting daughter churches that have come out of it. And so if you're looking around the world for a politically significant church that wants to restore its diplomatic relationships with the Roman government, and bring back all the churches that have left it, it's the church established at Nicaea. That church-state relationship has broken down, which has allowed things like the Protestant Reformation to happen. So you're looking at the Catholic Church, that it needs to revive its relationship with a resurrected Holy Roman Empire so that it can bring back all these daughter churches back to it. And it's actually having pretty good success in England, I guess, if it wants to reconquer the Anglican Church, that job's about 20% done. But then the next big thing we need to be watching for is not just the Anglican Church, but like the Lutheran Church. Because you look at a country like Germany, and the German population's roughly divided into thirds, one third Catholic, one third Lutheran, one third secular. And so you start getting something like this happens with the Lutheran Church. Then with the Lutheran Church and the Anglican Church, as you're starting to see, instead of religion being a factor that divides Europe, a religion being the factor that unites Europe.
That is a crucial and very practical part of the rise of this Holy Roman Empire. I think you can easily see, you know, religion as a whole has been on the retreat, and the kind of resurgence of religion and even the Catholic aspect of this has also been an important part of our latest Trumpet print edition. But you start having churches return to the fold after Nicaea, or the anniversary of Nicaea, and big developments like this. You can see that that would just turbocharge the role that the Catholic Church, the power and influence the Catholic Church has in Europe, and can quite quickly get the ball rolling towards Europe rising as this religious power, or religion providing the glue for that power. So a very important story. What else did you have for us from the European news this week?
Well, I think another big story here in the Anglo-American region is the release of the Epstein files. I've been watching this story for a long time. It's about a bit of a roller coaster. Well, after finally Donald Trump made this a campaign promise of his, that he was going to release the Epstein files, and then did a complete 180 after he was elected, saying it's all a Democratic hoax, and there's no story here, and people need to forget about this because they're not releasing anything. Then in another 180, President Trump seems to do a lot of those on tariffs and peace deals and other things. Came out this week and basically called on Republicans to release the files. They finally put it to a vote in the House of Representatives. Was almost a unanimous vote. I think there was one Republican who voted against releasing them on grounds that he thought it was going to stir up conspiracy theories and tarnish the reputations of some people who were innocent. But the rest voted unanimously to release it. The Senate voted unanimously. And then Donald Trump signed the bill. So those files have been released to the House Oversight Committee. They haven't made any announcements of what's in them. One prominent Democrat who's not in office, but used to be and still has high positions in academia, Larry Summers, has already resigned over some new allegations over his relationship with Epstein. Not a ton of details on that yet either. It seems like right now that Larry Summers and Prince Andrew are the two people who've really gotten some big pushback over their friendship with Epstein. But that, as the House Oversight Committee keeps releasing new information, we will have updates for you going forward. This is a big story, and as we usually point out when we cover this, it's only the tip of the iceberg. Jeffrey Epstein sexually abused something like 250 teenage girls over the course of two decades by promising them jobs at a massage parlor and then running like an illicit massage ring on his island, which is horrible. But it's also the tip of the iceberg in the fact that there's probably about a million people in the United States, close as they can calculate, who are in some form of human slavery or human trafficking. And about a quarter of those, 250,000, are in some form of sex trafficking. So there's drug cartels that do more business in a year than Jeffrey Epstein did in his entire career. Donald Trump's actually made some good progress. I think he's the latest statistics from Secretary Holman says that he's saved about 30,000 children from drug cartel sex rings in his efforts just to crack down on border security. But the sex trade in the United States is a huge story. We always talk about God's punishing America for its sins, raising up the Holy Roman Empire to correct it for its sins. The sex trade is a huge one of those sins that you don't hear much about. You generally only hear about it if it's Epstein, and that's because it's politically useful to accuse politicians of being friends with Epstein. So that's not to minimize what he did. There needs to be more focus on Epstein than there has been, but there needs to be even more focus on, like I said, the 200-some thousand people who were abused by people other than Epstein. And then two other quick stories. There's been some heating up in a political battle, just highlighting the political division of America over redistricting. The government of Texas tried to draw a new census map and redraw some of their congressional districts in order to get Republicans more seats in Congress. The Constitution only says that congressional districts have to be of roughly equal population, so it's kind of up to the state governments how they draw them. There's been some Obama-appointed judges that are ruling that Texas can't do that, I don't know enough about the nitty-gritty details of the law to know if the Texas plan was in violation of the law. It has been appealed to the Supreme Court, so we'll find more about it. But the main takeaway here is it's not only Texas. California, on the other hand, is trying to redraw their maps to do more seats for Democrats. And there's three or four other states have done this, so this is a developing front in the political battle for America, just trying to fight for control of the nation. And we know there was a ton of election fraud in the last election, not the 2024, but the 2020, with mail-in ballots and other things. So this story is something just keep an eye on, just highlighting the growing political division in America. And then also another revelation this week about just growing corruption in the food stamp program. About 42 million people collect food stamps in the United States. A lot of them almost lost their benefits during the recent government shutdown. But the Trump administration is taking a closer look at that. They found about 5,000 dead people who are collecting food stamps, even though they don't need to eat. And about 500,000 people who are getting food stamps twice, like they've been entered into the system twice, so they're getting enough food for two. So the person in charge of that program actually has admitted that it's one of the most corrupt programs in the United States government, and about 80% of the people on it don't actually even need to be on it. So they'll be getting some more information there in coming weeks and months about just more government corruption and wasteful spending in the United States.
Well, thank you very much for that, Andrew. We've had a lot of different talk about peace, failed ways of producing peace, how hopeless different peace efforts are on today's show. I wanted to conclude with just one more clip from Herbert W. Armstrong, where he was asked about how practically peace will come. And I think it is an important and encouraging perspective to end the show on.
But I feel what you have just said is only philosophy and does not offer any solution to our problems. How will that produce peace now?
It won't produce peace now. I'm just telling you the facts that what will produce peace. And I say to you that we human beings are not going to produce peace. I think that all religions, at least, know that there is a higher power. Many of them don't know what that higher power is. They don't have it defined, perhaps. because they don't know. But there is a higher power, and that higher power is going to have to come and bring us peace. We're not going to bring peace, but the great Creator, God, is going to have to intervene and bring us peace if He has to force it upon us. And that's the way peace is finally going to come.
World peace is on its way. It's just not going to come from doing a deal with Vladimir Putin, Saudi Arabia, or anybody else. Well, thank you so much for joining us this week. Thank you to all of our panelists. Thank you to George Haddad and Matthew Friesen for engineering and production. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at trumpetworld@thetrumpet.com. We'd be very happy to hear from you. We'll be back next week, where I think we'll be bringing you an interview from an expert on Cyprus, so you can keep your eye out for that. Until then, keep watching your world.